Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available 20-minute samples of recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new sample podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. In addition, you can access the full-length version of this and all NACSW podcasts at no cost simply by becoming a member of NACSW or by ordering a copy of this podcast at a reasonable cost on NACSW's online bookstore. We hope you enjoyed today's sample podcast.
So we're excited to have you all join us today for this webinar, and we will offer a couple of opportunities for you to give us some feedback. We won't just wait till the end because, as we can imagine, there may be some questions as we go through this. So that we have enough time to allow you to talk with us for us all to discuss ideas and process, we're going to go ahead and get started. So the title, hopefully everybody can see it, is Sharing the Story, Living and Teaching in the Shadow of Ferguson. We have four goals today with our presentation. Our goals are to talk about the impact that social work may have near a racially charged community. In our situation, we are near Ferguson, so we're going to talk about it from that angle, but we'll certainly open it up to what it's like in any related community. We'll describe the process of creating dialogue in response to crisis. So how does the university or academe respond when these things happen? We'll explore the values and challenges when you're trying to conduct these race dialogues, especially within predominantly white groups and communities, which is the face of higher education. And then finally, we'll articulate how faith, history, values, and perspectives, particularly the perspectives that I and Dr. Schreiber bring to the table, influence race communications in our setting, but how you might think about how it influences it in your setting. So we kind of have this group, this presentation group, across four areas. We'll talk about a little bit about the general stories. We'll share our story and our story at our university, some solutions that we came up with at the time, and we'll open it up to other solutions because some of what happened with Ferguson is certainly revisiting us now in history, in present time. And then some solutions, we'll ask you guys to open up and talk about some solutions and how you've dealt with this in your environment. So we ground this by saying race is a significant cultural challenge, right? Most of us know this in the profession. And the call for us all is how do we consider incidents that happen in our communities, on our campuses, in the community around our campus, and how does that impact the work that we're trying to do?
So to tell you a little bit about who we are and where we work, we work at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville, which is a mid-sized regional university. We're predominantly commuter students, and most of our students are from rural backgrounds. So even some of my graduate students have never been in a class with an African-American student throughout their undergrad as well as their high school. So we have some students who have very little exposure to African-American students. We also have some African-American students who come from Chicago or St. Louis who've grown up in predominantly African-American communities. So we have a wide range of students. 8% of our students are out of state. But most people are from our regional area. We are CSWE accredited. We have both BSW and MSW programs. Our faculty is rather small. We have 7 tenure track. Well, at the time that Ferguson occurred, we had 7 tenure track and 2 instructors. The students I talked about a little bit, they're mostly Christian, and many have had limited exposure to race. Our faculty, we have 7 white faculty, majority women faculty, and the context, as Kim referred to, was based on white academic framework. It's Christocentric, and we have even 1 pastor on our faculty and several people who published on issues of faith, and we have varying experiences and level of understandings of race and race issues. This is me. This is my family. You may notice that my family is diverse in its own right. My 3 kids are all adopted, and that's part of what have shaped my experience in the world and my knowledge of diversity. At the time Ferguson happened, I was the newest faculty member. We've had, since then, other faculties have joined us, but I was the newest faculty at that time. And I wasn't necessarily perceived as an ally by Kim or other African American colleagues. I am also Mennonite. That's my faith background. That's Christian. For those of you who have less theological background, it's kind of close to Amish. And I did graduate work both in theology and religious studies.
And so this is me. Unlike Joe, when we put this together, I didn't think about my family, not that they're important, but I put me. I identify as an African-American, a person of African-American descent. At the time that Ferguson happened, I was the only African-American in our department. We've since hired someone else, so that's not the story currently. But at the time that this happened, I was the only one in the department.
Tenured.
On tenure track in the department, right, because we had an instructor in the department at the time. For me, because of who I am at the time, the other person that worked in our department was an instructor, so she wasn't here all the time. So I became the source of what I call exploration. So the African-American social work students, both undergrad and grad, because we have both programs, would kind of seek me out for support, peer mentoring, negotiating academia, or negotiating their personal life stories. But I was also the source of exploration for many of our white students who were trying to understand, did not have any interactions. Jill discussed this or pointed it out earlier. Some of our students had limited interactions with African Americans in general, and so I was often told, "This, you're the first person that I've talked to that's African American. I've never met anybody like you." So the source of exploration came from both students across the racial spectrum, and I would also say from my peers trying to understand, other faculty in the department trying to understand how to negotiate race issues inside of our department. I am a resident of Ferguson. I've lived in the area for over 20 years. So I had a very unique, visceral response to the Ferguson verdict, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But I understand Ferguson, the history of Ferguson, and what the community was, is, and how people understand and appreciate the community. Equally, I, as an African-American female in the area, have had my own race-informed experiences living in that area. And so trying to make sense of what that means for me as an individual. Other relevant identities to this story is I come from a family of law enforcement, so I'm very sensitive to that narrative and what it means to be an officer, what it means to be an African American and a member of the law enforcement community, and that's a unique identity that my brother has and I have relatives that have. And I consider myself spiritual, and so how do I process that given this spiritual framework? So a little bit just about most of you know a little bit about Ferguson, but I just want to kind of give a little bit about how it played out here at our university. Ferguson happened, and as so many other places around the country, there was a lot of strong emotions, even with our small community, whether it was our faculty, our staff at the time, we had two secretaries, our instructors, our students, but there was anger, there was concern, there was sadness, certainly there was frustration trying to understand, like everyone else in this country, what is happening, what's going on. What also happened uniquely, and actually how it came to my attention, because I was in my own way of experiencing it, was students came to me and said, hey, African American students are feeling this way, or they're pulling away from us, or African American students feeling like people aren't understanding, or we can no longer have these discussions in class anymore because there's this kind of social fracture starting to happen, and it's coming because of how we're all experiencing the situation that's happened in Ferguson. And by the time it kind of came to us in the department, or at least came to me, it was at the time that the riots were happening. So it was well beyond Mike Brown's actual shooting. It was at a point where people had, the verdict had come out, and people were really struggling with how to make sense of that. And equally, we had students that certainly came to me that wanted to advocate, like, what can I do in my community or in my church? People are talking about it. Or how do I advocate on both sides? How do I advocate for the African-American story or families in poverty or African-American families? But how do I advocate because I have loved ones in law enforcement or in the military, and what does that mean? So there was a lot of impacted groups. Certainly for those of us who lived in the St. Louis area, particularly those that lived in Ferguson, those students found me immediately because they knew where I lived and we talked. But there were the impact also you know, rolled out into the region, the university, and the department.
And there was one. There were some specific incidents that happened on Facebook that were very disturbing and difficult for students. Some students posted some or liked some very racist things, and both African American students who had seen this from their colleagues and some of the white ally students who had seen this from their colleagues came and talked to Kim about that in particular.
So this is a little map just to give some context to all of this, this little drawn-out map. At the time that Ferguson happened, for those of us who lived in the area, because of this the riots and this armed state, there was we couldn't get home. Right, I remember saying to Jill as well as other faculty, I'm going to bring a bag to work. I don't know if I'll be able to get home tonight because of the streets being blocked. And I don't know what that means, and I have a young child. So, you know, as long as her dad has her or somebody can get her, then if I have to stay in Edwardsville, and Edwardsville is about 20 minutes away from the Ferguson area. So just to give people context who don't know our area. So I commute to Illinois, and I live in Missouri. But I was like, I don't know if I can get home. I don't know what that means. Grocery stores were closing at 4 and 5 o'clock before darkness fell. And I remember at one point in time, what they call the staging area that many of you would have seen on TV, we were going to Target, was at the staging area, and my daughter had this very visceral, emotional response, and she said, "This is just our neighborhood." And I get emotional talking about it now because I remember the look on her face like, "This is our neighborhood. Like, this is all over TV, and this is just where we live." And it reminded me of how people was viewing this situation roll out, and it's like for us, we're like, this is just a neighborhood like any other American town. So this map came about because one of the nights that I got home when rioting had really peaked, several of the students would check on me and make sure everything was okay, and some of them lived in the St. Louis area, but I was sending them all of the little square boxes here that you see, the red boxes, are where fires were starting and where things were popping off. And in this PowerPoint, there's a space in here where there's like a little, I guess a marker with a little A. That's where I lived. And so I was kind of showing them, here's where I am in this yellow space. But near me, there's a Shop and Save up at the top. That's kind of where I get off the highway to go home. The map is a little bigger than what you can see here, but this just burned, and that just burned. And we can smell the smoke, and I can hear the sirens, or, we're scared to go outside of our house. And the irony is the fear that we have wasn't so much the fear of the rioting, because in some ways I understood people's frustration and anger, because I had driven home many times and would get pulled over for no reason. But it was the fear of what does it mean to have this military state in this space that's such a beautiful space, and now it's threatening our ability to just live. So there was a big reaction to this, and this image is just kind of reminds me of what that reaction was and how students were processing this with me.
And so, and Kim sent this, the hand-drawn, it was actually a hand-drawn map of her region to me, and I was aware of how powerful and visceral this was for her in her home. And I was aware that she, at the time that she was trying to take care of herself and her family, she was also the person that had to take care of our department. And that seemed like a particularly heavy burden. And so...
Yeah, and I will add to that, I think it was not just taking care of the department, but because there was a bit of taking care of the department, my colleagues trying to understand, the students trying to understand, but also defending my space. So, I mean, what that means for me as an African-American, feeling like many times I have to defend who I am as an African-American in life anyways, but now I have to defend my home space, right? I can remember walking into the department once and students and an adult were talking about, you know, why don't those people, why are they tearing up their neighborhood, and why, and I remember walking in that morning going like, wow, like, no, you don't even understand how deep this is, and you don't understand that there's some of these people don't feel connected to this neighborhood, and that particular store you saw being looted is a person who is very racist, and not that the looting is okay, but there's it's much more complex than some of the images that are being portrayed. So I think there was a need to, for understanding across the spectrum.
So this might be a good time to have questions.
You can open it.
Good. I will open up the line.
I'm going to first say, I know in the chat, if some people are chatting, and so I appreciate, Jim, your chat, because, yes, I am from the Blue Line family. And for people that don't know, that means we're from a law enforcement line. So if you want to chat, we're watching that as well. I just want to acknowledge that.
Thanks. The lines are now open for anyone who has a comment or would like to raise a question. Kim, this is Rick. One question that occurs to me, were you in communication with other faculty at other academic programs for support for some of the unique challenges that were on your plate? In some ways, it sounds like almost single-handedly on your plate, but were you in contact with other colleagues in other environments that were able to
I'm struggling with that a little bit. I have colleagues that are at some of the universities and social work departments on the Missouri side of the river. So there's St. Louis University, Washington University, University of Missouri St. Louis, we call UMSL. So I had been in contact with some of them because they either lived in my area or I just knew them from living over in St. Louis for so long. I never shared with them what I was experiencing, and I think a part of it is because even though in hindsight it felt, I realized it was a long time that these things were progressing. It was happening so fast. And as this was happening, there's also this this concern with, I just got to do what I'm supposed to do in my daily life, right? I got to take care of my child and educate her. I got to get to work. I have to buy groceries. I remember a couple times going to Jill, like, I'm going to have to buy groceries over here because I know by the time I get home, because I teach night classes, grocery stores are going to be closed. I had action. I'm going to park my car here. My partner's name is John, and I would say, I'm going to park here. I know how to walk home if I need to walk home. So I think things were happening so fast that even the people I was talking with on the Missouri side and faculty at those universities, we were all just making sense of it. And many of those were African-American faculty, but it was like we were making sense of what that meant for our personal lives, us being people who identify as African-American, what it means for the country, and what it meant in our respective settings. So we didn't necessarily share stories across our settings, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Sounds incredibly hard, Kim.
So we can go back to the presentation. Was there a question?
Okay, good. Any last ones before we mute lines back up? Okay, Jill and Kim, back to you.
Okay, so social work, of course, has a to the code of ethics, and we included this connection because it's really clear that we as social workers need to deal with issues of race and what was happening in Ferguson because of service, because of social justice, because of the importance of human relationships, and because we need to be competent to deal with issues of race. And that we also have ethical standards of competence and cultural competence and social diversity. These are all part of, right straight from our code of ethics, that make it clear that this is not an issue that's peripheral to social work, it's central to social work and social work ethics. And so, I'm going to let you do this part.
So, that this kind of gets at Rick's question earlier, kind of how I was connecting to other people, and part of that was being a part of my university's response. So when this happened in our area, at SIUE, I think it's important to also give a little bit more context, many of our faculty live in Missouri. There's a small group of us that live in Ferguson, but many people commute from Missouri into Illinois because of where Edwardsville is located in respect to St. Louis. So there was a unique reaction from the campus because so many faculty lived in the Missouri, in the St. Louis area, not necessarily Ferguson, but in the St. Louis area. So one of the first things that I remember happening when this all kind of started to evolve was one of the faculty members, she lives in Ferguson, kind of sent the email through our listserv saying, we need to talk about this. What's going to happen if students try to process this? Let's pull together. So we had a staff, faculty-staff town hall meeting. It kind of just came together. It wasn't really formal. So if you missed that listserv, as we all know, we get tons of emails, then you didn't know it happened. It was kind of authentic. We pulled into a big lecture room, and it was just, let's talk, let's share. So it was great because it was this outlet for expression, to let's talk about what's happening. And this was right before rioting really started, that people kind of like, let's talk about how our students will respond. Because it kind of happened so naturally, it wasn't really mapped out. So there wasn't necessarily formalized a communication process. social work department wasn't involved at, to any extent. And,
I didn't even know about any of, like, I didn't know any of this.
Yeah. And there were no students there. And actually, ironically, some of the people there were staff who were also graduate students, and they pointed out, why are not more students here? Students didn't know about this. This was in the faculty listserv. So, you know, this idea of pulling us together to provide support and comfort and kind of allow people to express, there was some really tense times because people felt like, why did this not come from administration? Why is it coming from a listserv? So it was an interesting dynamic, and it was probably about an hour and a half of this meeting lasted. Other responses, eventually our chancellor at the time sent out an email message to our university community. Our Office of Diversity and Inclusion, which we have here, hosted a forum and some resource events, and so social work was involved. Some of us went to the forum. That came a little bit later. There was a resource drive to collect goods, food and all for people, so we participated in that. And then there was a Black Lives Matter demonstration, which a few in the social work department participated in that.
And so what did we do in our department? So that's a little bit more about what the university did. In our department, there were three things that we did. We had letters that went to students. We had race dialogues intentionally set up. And we had curriculum responses. And we're going to talk about each of those formally. We also had some less formal responses. There was some small group exchanges. There was some professors, but not most, some professors chose to discuss it in their class. Kim and I both did, but many professors didn't even discuss it in class. And there was some student group involvement that we talked about the drives.
The other thing that came out was a letter to students. So as I tried to process this, and even going through the classes, I remember many of my colleagues saying, can you come to my class? Can you talk to my class about it? Which I was glad to do, but it was a really interesting space to be in, to have to be the deliverer of the message or help students understand. But in the process of doing that, I realized I wanted to write a letter. I wanted students to understand what it was like for me and my brown and black skin, what that was like for me to be not just experiencing Ferguson and being a resident of the area, but to be in this space where, and I say to them, where many of you have never been around someone like me and are unsure what to do with me when I step into the classroom for the first time. And so to understand who I am, this urban African-American woman who's still trying to understand rural white America, and so your stories are new to me. So I wanted to talk about that, and I wanted to talk about what I was really going through. Many of them had seen me cry about the situation with Ferguson, talking to classes. So I'm like, I want to write my own letter. At the time, our department chair was writing a statement, and our department, the process is very communal. So even though our chairs write letters, they kind of send it to all of us. We're a small camp and go like, hey, anybody want to chime in? What do you think? How does this sound? But for me, that was going to take too long, and there needed to be something that needed to be said more immediate. So I wrote a letter. In the spirit of my department, I did send it around to everyone and go, hey, what do you guys think? And most people were very supportive. Some people had editing concerns. But I felt like, you know what, doesn't matter. I just wanted to show you out of respect, but I am sending this to students. So we had two letters. My letter went out to all of the students, particularly those that I taught or had taught, and then our chair ultimately delivered a letter from our department.
And this was a really interesting time in our department. We had a lot of senior faculty with less, many of them have retired now, but I remember they put the Ferguson issue in the center of the agenda at our faculty meeting. And our chair at the time started at the top of the agenda, and then when we got to Ferguson, she skipped it and said, okay, there's a couple things at the bottom we need to do, and then we worked from the bottom so that Ferguson was the very last thing on the agenda, and then we didn't have time to discuss it. So there were some challenges trying to help our department be present to how this is not just in a abstract way but in a very real place, because Kim wasn't the only person. We had students who lived in Ferguson
right.
as well. And so it was for some of our students as well as for Kim. This was a really relevant
yeah.
and visceral topic, and we couldn't ignore it as it, I felt like we couldn't ignore it as a faculty. And so one of the things that we wanted to set up was a chance for people to talk about this. And it was met with resistance initially, but eventually we were allowed to have a dialogue. It was unfortunately, around, by this time in the process, it was getting close to finals, and there was like, no, we can't do it now, it's finals time. And then there was a yes, no, we need to. And so we had two discussions, dialogues, where we invited faculty and students to come, and we had about, oh, I think one was about 15 mm-hmm. people and one was about 20, that we had meet and talk about it. It included African-American, it included white, it included students, it included grad students, and it included faculty. And Kim and I facilitated these dialogues, and we discussed kind of how we felt, and the students could process how they felt. And it was, we were intentional about how we organized it and what we planned, and we had specific broad questions that we'd worked out ahead of time to ask. I had worked in diversity dialogues at my PhD program, and I had done dialogues there in a formal educational process, and so I had some knowledge about that. And Kim certainly had the lived experience to bring, and we had two of these very powerful discussions.
I want to add, too, with those dialogues, even though Ferguson was the thing that brought it to happen, like brought it to pass, the dialogue really was more about how do we understand these kind of charged issues in society, and how do we respond as social workers. And I can remember the particular second one was really a platform for how do we, outside of the classroom, talk to each other, right? Yes, we're in class together, and we do activities and group work, but here's this space for us to just talk about what it means. We had a student that was from East St. Louis, and so what does it mean to be from East St. Louis, and how are you perceived as an African-American male, and you're the only African-American male at the time, I think, in our department, and being in these classes. So what is that like? And I can remember that there was these periods for me that felt very transformative, where students were like, oh, I never knew that about you. Oh, I thought you were. Oh, I thought your story was like, oh, so it was more than just being about Ferguson, but it was a space for us just to talk about what it means to be our unique selves and still advocate for justice.
And it was important enough that some of our, I know at least one of our African-American students took vacation time from work to be able to come to it. I mean, it was really important that we did this. And then we had, one of the things that came out of that discussion was, you have to do change where you can in your sphere of influence. If you're a practicum student, what can you do in that role? If you're if you have a church, what can you do in that role? If you are working in an agency, what can you do? If you're a professor, what can you do in that role? And so I took this really to heart. And so this was like really finals week. And what I did was I completely revamped the curriculum for my group class. And what I did was we hire students to be actors for our. That's part of our pedagogy in our department. So we've always done this, and we've done it for individual and we've done it for group, where we hire actors intentionally in to be, to pretend to be clients so that our students can practice with them. We call it that simulated clients. And for my group class, I intentionally revamped it to be specifically about race, and I could hire in the actors that represented different racial groups and perspectives. And then I had the topic be around diversity, and the backstory was that all of these people in the group were part of the same company that had a class action lawsuit, and that the social workers were the people charged with teaching them about racial sensitivity. So that my social work students were coming and talking to people who looked different than them about issues of oppression, or race, or microaggressions, or stereotypes. And so that was a very explicit way of helping our students develop the skills to talk about race. And I included in for this presentation, the study I did of that. I continue to do that every year, and I have gathered both quantitative and qualitative data about how effective that is at teaching students to discuss race. And so that was something that changed in a very concrete, specific way as a response to the dialogues that we had.
I'm going to add to that, too. It's interesting. You know, we've talked about this a lot, but I think about Jill doing that, and I really appreciate that she did that. You know, we call them sims, the people we hire. We hire these sims because they're simulating a case or a situation. But I never, you know, thought about making it more of a deliberate action, because whenever I would have sims for class, I would always go, nope, I need some more sims. Do we have anybody who represents gender identities? Do we have international students? Do we have African? You know, I kind of would just run around saying that to her as she hired. I would kind of go like, I want them. Like, I don't want you know, people would apply for the job, and I'd look, and I'm like, yeah, no. Jill, can we get more international students? I want to create that kind of scenario. Never making it deliberate, but it was more who I am, because at the time, my feeling was just, I get what many of our students will go back to their home spaces and practice social work, but there's a big world out there, and I want, if they see somebody like me, or they see somebody like people I grew up with, or they see some person who identifies as an international person or refugee, I want them to be comfortable working it. So when she did this, for me it was like confirming of, yes, yes, now it's becoming not just something I'm running around doing, but it's becoming something that's becoming more deliberate in our department, and that was good.
It also built on the diversity class. You know, we had the required diversity class, but the students who participated in the evaluations of this class said that talking about diversity in an abstract way in a class is not the same as having to face it and talk about it with people who look different than you, that takes a different set of skills. And so that was one concrete thing that came out of the discussions. Are there questions at this point?
All right, questions at this point.
This is Stephanie from Minnesota.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. A question I have is, Jill, you said at the beginning that you weren't perceived as an ally.
Yes.
If I understood that right.
In fact, so I'm curious, sorry, just recounting that story now. We were out to dinner early in my tenure here, and I said, do you trust me? And she's like, no.
And so I think
how you navigated that, and how, for those of us that are seeking to be allies, and I currently teach adjuncts, I'm an instructor, and a course on immigrants and refugees, and my class is racially diverse, and we do spend time talking about racism, and but just kind of how you navigated that, and suggestions in terms of how one can be an effective ally, or navigate that. Developing. In either of you to comment on that.
I think that what I can do, I can tell you what I tried, but I think it's maybe more important for Kim to tell you why she now does perceive me.
Right, right.
Talk about what you tried.
Okay, so the things that I did, it really, for me personally, I wanted to support my colleagues. I mean, the original motivation was, I saw Kim, who was living in Ferguson, struggling with her like basic needs, like food, shelter, taking care of her child, and also having this whole lot of extra work at the time that she should have had less work because she was dealing with a family crisis. And in kind of just a typical social work compassion way, I was motivated, okay, what can I do? And so I went into Kim's office and I said, send the students to me, I'll talk to them. And she's like, uh-uh, you can't talk to them. They're coming to me for a reason. I have that responsibility. And I'm like, okay, what can I do to make the students realize that I am trustworthy and competent about thinking and talking about race so that some of the white students and some of the black students could choose to come to me so that it doesn't all fall on her. And so I really thought about what I could do. And so that was part of what motivated the changing the curriculum. And I just became much more explicit about talking about it in class. And I also upped my ally work in the standing beside, confronting issues in the classroom or in the department, and being willing to be to speak out more explicitly and vocally. And, you know, when I first came in, when you're a first-year professor, you just want to get tenure. And it's easy to get caught up in that I'm not going to push waves because I don't want to jeopardize my own personal career. But pretty quickly, I realized that that wasn't going to be able to align with my values. And so concrete actions, like in that particular faculty meeting where the Ferguson thing got to left to the end and the chair was like, we don't need to address this, I spoke up and said, absolutely, we can't skip this. This is too important. That was just one little, like, way I could be supportive.
And I'll kind of echo that. I think we did recount the story, and she's like, I remember the first time I asked you, like, do you trust me? And I'm like, yeah, no, I don't know you. And so I want to validate Jim's chat that, you know, sounds like, you know, being in a law enforcement family. So I certainly have a bit of that, like, one eye open all the time. I don't know about people. People can't be trusted. So I certainly have a little bit of that. But I think how people become allies for me and how I eventually realized it was an ally, because I have no choice but to walk the journey, right? I have no choice but to wear my black skin and to wonder how people feel about me. I'm crying now, so if people can see. I'm not going to apologize because I feel like we don't apologize for laughing, so why the hell do we apologize? But what I noticed was she was willing, when she could say no and when she didn't have to, she was willing to sacrifice and walk it with me. Not just me, but our students. So when she said she came to me and was like, what can I do? And I was like, well, no, I think I have to be the one to tell the story. I have to be the one that students want to connect with. And there was one, you know, Caucasian student at the time. I remember she was in my office a lot, but she was like, I don't understand this idea of privilege. And I know you guys teach us this, but I don't feel like I have privilege. But I know I can talk to you about it. And I remember one time thinking, like, I could probably just say, Jill, help me here. But I didn't. I used the example of a baby doll, and I said, if you go in the store right now, I pulled up Amazon. I'm like, let's look at the baby dolls. How many of these baby dolls do we see have hair like mine? How many of them have skin like mine? How many of them have a nose like mine? This is my life, right? But I have to advocate that the baby should look like me, because I want my kids to know that it's okay to look the way you look. And that moment, that was just a casual example, she started crying, and she's like, I never thought about it like that. And I remember thinking, well, this is why I don't pass it to Jill, because she can't say that the way I can say that. She can't help that student understand it in that way. But yet, even though Jill didn't take that on, I saw her with her class, right? And I saw her go, like, I know what I can do, and I can do this. I saw her go, I mean, there were times she would come and go, can I help you with grading? Can I help you with something else? If you have to do this, and I respect that, what can I do? So she became an ally. I think the other point to this is that it takes time to become an ally. And I think there is this false myth that because people say they are an ally, you're automatically an ally. And I certainly know, for me, I have to see you do it. Everyone can say they're an ally, but it's like, I want to just sit back and watch you. Because being an ally means that you will hurt and suffer, like me, to promote change. And that you might lose when I lose. And that's a hard walk for some people. And it's respectable when you don't want to lose, but it's like, being an ally means taking it to another level.
Another thing that happened was that she realized that her voice was not always heard in the way that my voice was.
Yes.
And so that there were times that she would come into my office and say, okay, Jill, this needs to be said. Yes. Would you say it for me?
Yeah.
And I'd be like, of course. I'm happy to say it for you. And so, like, to say Kim said this, but just to, like, bring up the issue that she had concerns about that she didn't feel like she could bring up. Your question?
Thank you.
Back to the presentation then. So the dialogue, the learning how to talk to people who are different than you and having groups, there's formal ways to do that. There's program on intergroup relations. There's other dialogue classes where you intentionally make a diverse group and talk about difficult topics. What we did was more, so like there's curricular kinds of dialogues. What we did was more informal process dialogues. And so that's what I'm saying. It takes different forms. And it creates a safe space, although more recently people are not saying it's not safe. It's hard work. It's a brave space to foster communication. You have to be brave and you have to be willing to be there and hear hard things. And that's not always, safe may not be the goal. The goal may be learning, and between individuals of various racial and ethnic identities.
So what are the challenges to trying to do this race dialogue, formally? First of all, who's going to bring that to the forefront, right? Who communicates it, how they're communicating it? I think, and who are they communicating it to? In spaces in academe, it should come from leadership. We're going to talk a little bit about recent events in our area, again in St. Louis and even on our campus. But it's very important that people respond immediately and that they're very strong statements of what is and what is not acceptable behavior and that they respond to the broader community, that students don't get excluded. It shouldn't just come to faculty, or it shouldn't just go to students and not faculty, because this impacts our whole community. So it's important to think about whether the timing of this communication, you know, in the event of a crisis, I need to know, if you want to be my ally, that you will respond right now, because guess what? The crisis is happening right now. Next week may be too late. Next week I'm in another crisis. Versus going, I want to be a planned community, and I want to know that we have these plans of action. And if these things happen, we are ready to go. And talking about what that means. And I will say, for us, when it came to Ferguson, we were not planned department. We kind of responded. You know, we didn't even really do good crisis response. We kind of just responded because there was kind of this outcry. You know, people knew Jill, and that was a great example of Jill knew what I was going through, so she kind of said, hey, we need to do something. Kim's going through this, because I wasn't going to say that, because I'm dealing with what are those stereotypes and what does that mean for me? Being the only, do I say I'm dealing with this? Is it like, Kim, why are you dealing with this? Is it, Kim, you're weak? Is it, Kim, that's not your problem? So I needed her to be my voice to go, okay, we need to do something. How do you deal with race anxieties? I can remember when we were talking about this, when it kind of got shimmied over in the meeting a little bit, you know, people going, this is uncomfortable. These are uncomfortable conversations. Yes, it's uncomfortable. I don't feel bad about that, because our lives, for some of us, across gender spectrum, across the ethnic spectrum, across the race spectrum, our lives are uncomfortable every day. We wake up in discomfort. But I remember that feeling of people, you know, they verbally said, this is hard stuff to talk about, as if that's an excuse for us not to engage in this hard work. Scheduling it, when we got to the point that we were like, we're going to do something, how do we schedule it? We teach in our department daytime and evening. So finding a time that made sense, whether people could come or not come, didn't matter if all the faculty could be there, but we know we need to do that, recognizing that it's important work, having resources. You know, Jill had done race dialogues before, so she had some insight. She was able to go back and pull stuff that she had done. So whether it's knowledge, skills, people, experiences, being able to pull that together, and including, you know, the person that's affected. And in this situation, it was me as the minority person. I certainly, when we had these dialogues, I reached out to the minority students because I have a unique bond with them and said, hey, you guys need to be there. If you can't be there, anything you want me to say, making sure that that voice is recognized and doesn't get dismissed.
And now we want to transition into kind of how we responded to the Stockley verdicts. And so once again, we have now two new faculty. Both of them live in St. Louis. Both of them can walk to the protest. They're that close. One of them has already done so and been part of it. And so it's once again a relevant issue, and we're doing it again. It's kind of like, I was telling Kim, it's a little bit like Groundhog Day. It feels like we get to practice this until we get it right. And I feel like we're doing something better this time. And one thing was that we came up with a letter from our faculty that was much stronger and more clear, and it was quicker in response this time, that was able to happen better, and we all could chime in on it and respond. And so that was a better. We haven't had a dialogue officially yet, but there's been a lot more discussions, I think, in classrooms this time. There's been better response from a variety of faculty to talk about it in their classrooms.
I think the other thing that's different, too, about our attempt at a response now in the letter is that the letter before was more, this is Ferguson, this thing has happened, we all have emotions and feelings, it's okay to have these emotions and feelings, let's process this. The letter now, after the Stockley verdict, and I will also add, it's not just the Stockley verdict, we've had some situations in our campus community that have been concerning and disturbing, if I can use a stronger word, but the letter this time is not just, this is what's happening, this is how you feel, but it's also, we will not tolerate this. This is good social work behavior. This are our code of ethics, and our ethics call us to. So I think it's a bit stronger in that it's not just helping people process what they feel, and we're here to help you, but it's more, this is what it means to be a social worker, and we expect you to behave as such. And that, to me, feels different.
Yes. Was there more about this, Dunkley?
No.
Okay, great.
So what's inadequate? What you know, this is us knowing it, but also what we know from the literature, what isn't adequate is this idea of being invisible, putting your head in the sand or your head in the clouds, however you want to think about it, that it doesn't exist. Because it does exist, and while it may not be happening, these tense issues, these conversations around race, these conversations around ethnicity, these conversations, I keep talking about gender because I think that's a part of the equation, while it may not be happening right now in your face, it's still going on, and our systems are built off of these very faulty ways of thinking. So you have to be accountable to it, and you have to talk about it. Being naive that it'll go away, it's not going away. I think there are segments of our society who can step away from the conversation, and it's hard for me to understand what that means because people can't step away, right? What they do is they leave academia because they can't step away, or they leave these other institutions, whatever they may be, because they can't step away. But it's not going away. Being scared, it makes me uncomfortable. That's the, you know, I don't want to talk about it. I don't really know how to talk about it. Well, neither do I. But we have to begin to talk about it to come up with very viable solutions to address it. The additive model. The additive model is this model that person who's in that minority subgroup or the African-American person can take it on. And respecting what that means, taking on, talking to African-American students and other students, you know, my story is not unique. Certainly other faculty have talked about it. I've had students from non-social work students find me, and I always think, how do they find me? And they're like, hey, I'm thinking about whatever, public health, I'm thinking about nursing, I looked you up. Because we don't have a lot of African-American faculty here at SIUE, but they kind of look you up, and you become this mentor. And for me, the mentor is not just about academic mentor, but it's like, you need a life mentor, and that's really what you're coming to ask me for, somebody to help you negotiate growing up as a professional and what that means, because maybe you've never had that in your life, somebody to help you understand when you come across racism in the work field and how do you still go to work and how do you still smile. And so there's this additive model. And ironically, I think in the department sometimes people add to it. So faculty come to me. And there are times I've said to Jill, like, I just want to be Kim. I don't want to talk about black. I don't want to talk about what it means to be black. I just want to talk, like, why can't I do that? But yet I know there is a bit of responsibility that I feel, and I've heard other faculty talk about feeling where I still need to talk. I can't get tired because if she doesn't talk to me, now Jill's a little different, but if people don't talk to me, who are they going to talk to, and what assumptions do they walk away with? So in order for me to stop the assumptions and the stereotypes, I have to always find this energy to do the extra work, whatever that means. And then creating unconscious support spaces. You know, there's these spaces where race dialogues are not shared or encouraged. And you just know, you know, I know who I can have these conversations with. I don't have any people here at SIUE who said you can't have that conversation with me. But I know who I can have the conversation with, right? I know where it's safe. I know where I'm comfortable. I know where you really want to learn my story and help me negotiate it or willing to go out on the limb. And I think sometimes we have these false support safe spaces that really aren't safe, and so we wonder why people aren't coming to the meeting or talking about it. You know, why don't you talk about it at faculty meeting? It's like, yeah, that's not really a safe space. So just being aware that that's an inadequate way to address this.
So we need to be aware of what proportion of our students represent minorities in different capacities and what proportions of our faculty, and that's going to affect our ability to have discussions. And that's where, like, hiring in students that can represent different things for my group class where I hire in actors. And the lovely thing is when I hire in actors, I hire in actors that are international students, hire in actors that are avid Trump supporters. I hire in actors that are African immigrants that are having issues with the African Americans. Mm-hmm. So, like, I can hire in the diversity, and then they can put out there verbally what my students may be feeling and experience. You know, the police, I have the person who's former military who's the police doing security in the store. And so that allows the students to see a variety of perspectives in the group, in the fishbowl, while they're watching these things happen, and they can see alternative ways and practice facilitating those discussions. We need to expect it to be uncomfortable. I try really hard to teach my students that the goal is to learn how to be comfortable being uncomfortable. and that there is a extra cultural burden in taxation and commodification of our African American colleagues, and we need to figure out ways to support them above and beyond, like expecting them to do everything that the white faculty do, plus all this extra isn't fair. So part of what we do together is spend time with each other and learn from each other and support each other. Because this work is hard and you need to have colleagues. And if you don't have colleagues to work with who look different than you and that can help you give you insights, I encourage you to figure out, or first try to figure out why you don't, and then figure out what you can do to help change that and how can you reach out to people who are different and intentionally seek out opportunities to speak to people who are different.
Yeah, I would just echo that. I just think how you get through some of this is at a very micro level, right? Building bridges below, because these, you know, I keep saying the systems are so broken, and I think, you know, we're reaching spaces in society, and this is a little bit of a repeat of history where there are times in society where we recognize this, wow, our systems are broken, and then all of a sudden we kind of go back into our little worlds and do what we do. But systems are broken, but in order for us to address this situation and try to change it and advocate for change or promote change, we have to connect below, authentically connect below, and be willing to be vulnerable in that. And I know Jill and I have done that. You know, there are times I talk to her and I'm like, I'm just going to say this, you know, white people, and I feel, and she's there and she's listening and she's hearing me, and then she'll, you know, share something and no one's upset. We don't walk away angry, but it's like, I can do that with Jill, and it's so reassuring. And I can process what it feels like for me or what I'm experiencing or what a student said to me. And I know she is putting herself in my shoes and empathizing with me, but equally I can empathize with her journey and her world. So I think that's where you start.
Okay, so what we would like to know is what you guys have done in your institutions or in your own personal life that have helped you develop more racial awareness or helped your students be able to develop some of that capacity. And we're looking for some more ideas so that we can share broadly, not just our perspective, but a lot of people.
Thank you for listening today to this 20-minute sample of NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. Just a reminder that you can access the full-length version of this and all NACSW podcasts at no cost by simply becoming a member of NACSW or by ordering a copy of this podcast at a reasonable cost on NACSW's online bookstore. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops, which provide CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, and our online continuing education program. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in to our podcast session today.